Thank you. And thanks to the organizers for the invitation to participate in this symposium. It's been very interesting. I'm going to be talking about something that's quite a bit different, but still sort of exists at this nexus, the soil chemistry, food security, and human health nexus. I think that there's a lot of exciting areas for research in this domain, including what we've been hearing about today, which is, I said there would be a cursor, so maybe I'll just use this instead. So macro and micronutrient concentrations in edible portions of plants do exhibit strong dependence on soil chemistry. There are emerging relationships as well, I think, that we haven't talked about that relate to soil quality and phytonutrients, particularly trace phytonutrients like these listed here in plant tissue in relation to soil quality and the soil microbiome. And it's known that some of these can prevent disease and promote health and healing and well-being. This is sort of an area, I think, for potentially for future research that a lot of us have not yet become totally aware of. That's not what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to talk instead about some non-agricultural land management activities that also introduce toxic elements, in particular arsenic, into food, water, and air. And I think that there are opportunities for soil chemists in particular to become engaged in, to a greater extent than they have been, in this area in general of environmental risk assessment for human health, where one has a source term, and that can be a geogenic source or it could be an anthropogenic source that's acted upon by environmental forcing, such as climate or something similar, to give rise to an exposure. And of course, exposure has several exposure-related attributes that depend on the patterns of behavior of individuals in proximity to the source. And that exposure gives rise to various doses, and those doses can differ depending on the nature of the exposure, and as I'll show, the speciation in particular, and that can then result in a health effect. And while this domain, the sort of dose-response domain, is the domain of biomedical scientists and molecular toxicologists, really this whole other part of the spectrum, from source term to dose, has a strong need for soil chemistry expertise. And I hope to make that case sort of through a case study example that I'll talk about today that we've been working on in Arizona. And this is part of a University of Arizona, where I'm from, Superfund research program. It's funded by the National Institutes of Health, in this case the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. And we're interested in these areas throughout the Southwest that have been mined. The southwestern U.S. is heavily mined for copper ore in particular, but other precious metals, because of the high prevalence of copper ore deposits in the area and their accessibility. And they result in mine waste deposits that are basically legacy waste deposits that sit on the landscape over very long periods of time. And they're devoid of vegetation for decades to hundreds of years. As a result, their source terms, if you will, they often have high concentrations of arsenic, copper, lead, zinc, etc. They can be sources of groundwater contamination, as shown here. They can also be sources, that groundwater contamination can propagate to drinking water wells, where communities are typically closely aligned with the development of these mining sites, mining communities very often. They can also be important sources, because they're devoid of vegetation, they can be important sources of off-site dust transport. And so dust can be transported off of these mining waste sites and impacted upon these communities, the individuals, and their homes. So there's a couple of different potential pathways for contaminant transport. And I wanted to discuss this in the context of a particular case study that several of us at the University of Arizona have been working on in this Superfund research program, and this is the Iron King Mine Humboldt Smelter Site. It's located in central Arizona, a little bit north of Phoenix. And the mine tailing site is located in close proximity to the town of Dewey Humboldt. So here's the town right across the street from the mine site that also has a smelter site over here that I'm not really going to talk about. I'm going to focus on this tailings material. It's a sulfide ore body that was mined until 1967 for lead, zinc, and also for precious metals, gold, silver. Very high arsenic concentrations, was not one of the target metals or metalloids in the mining, of course, but it's in the thousands of parts per million. And the Superfund, it made the Superfund National Priorities List in 2008. It's a semi-arid site, 400 millimeters of rain, substantially higher potential evapotranspiration, and so this is really what governs a lot of the diagenetic alterations that occur in the tailings that I'll mention. Mean annual temperatures, 14 degrees C. So some of the research questions we have are, what are the effects of proximity to the Superfund site on exposure to arsenic through soil, PM10, house dust, tap water, and home vegetable gardening? There's not any very large agricultural fields in close proximity to this site, but there are a lot of home gardens that are nearby, and so those are tested for some of the contaminant chemistry. What are the impacts of soil chemical transformations on contaminant bioaccessibility? How do we translate the exposure to these specific types of toxicants in their form to a dose? And so I'd like to sort of generally also address the question of how soil chemistry expertise enters into a study such as this kind of ecotoxicological or environmental toxicology study. And this involves the work of a lot of different graduate students and faculty, so I'm going to put pictures of some of them in here as I forget to mention them as we're going through it. But so it's clear from some of the work that's been done that these tailings are an important source of dust transport or emission off-site. Dust emissions here, dust fluxes off-site in grams per meter squared per year on the order of 2,400, 2,300. Very high values of dust transport off-site and potential impacts on neighboring communities. Even when we irrigate essentially double the annual rainfall, we have very high dust transport off-site nonetheless. It reduces it some, but not statistically significantly. However, if we establish a vegetative cap on the tailings through direct introduction of compost and planting, then we can actually turn these into dust sinks, so they eliminate the dust transport off-site. Nonetheless, most of these sites are unvegetated. Vegetating them is a remediation idea that's being proposed and is economically feasible. It can be done at pretty low cost. The tailings have on the order of 3 to 5 grams per kilogram of arsenic, so 3,000 to 5,000 parts per million. And we have evidence of geodust transport off-site into soils, because soils contain much higher than background concentrations, and this is in that residential area, on the order of 300 to 500 milligrams per kilogram, depending on proximity to the tailing site, decreasing typically with distance. And this also translates into house dust concentrations that are elevated in arsenic, and there's a statistical correlation between the soil concentrations and the house dust concentrations. The dust fall rate as well, but also the well water concentrations tend to be correlated as well with soil concentrations, an indication of proximity to the site, presumably, and the groundwater plume that's impacting these well waters. And so there are a variety of potential environmental media that are influencing exposure for the community. And this is work that's been spearheaded by some College of Public Health colleagues. So, in addition to that, there are direct relationships between these environmental media concentrations and concentrations in biological media, in particular urine and toenails, which are biological materials that can be tested for arsenic and tend to be good measures of arsenic exposure. Again, correlation coefficients are all significant at these p-values for relationships between residential soil, house dust, tap water, and these biological indicators of dose, if you will. So I should mention that this is based on a survey of 70 children that were in 34 households, so on the average of 2 kids per household, that live 0 to 7 miles away from the mine tailing site. In addition, there are urinary CC16. This is a club cell secretory protein, CC16, that decreases in concentration with increasing arsenic concentration in the soil. And so this again is another indication. This is not, well, so what this lung protein, or this protein in urine, I'm sorry, is an indication of decreased lung function. With decreasing concentration of this protein in urine, there's an observation of decreased lung function in children, and that can actually be manifest in adulthood through exposures in childhood that diminish CC16 concentrations. You can have diminished lung function in adulthood. And so there's also a statistically significant decrease in this protein concentration with increasing arsenic concentration in the soil. So we've done some work collaboratively with some folks in the Chemical Environmental Engineering Department that published this paper in Chemosphere in 2015, looking at how the exposure to dust transported from the site diminishes with increasing distance from the site. So lead isotopes can be used for that purpose. We have lead isotopic signature of the Iron King tailings shown here, and the lead isotopic signature deviates as you go away from the source towards a background signature shown here. So this lead isotopic signature can be used as an indicator of the extent to which the dust from the tailings pile has influenced the various different community occupants. And one of the things that we see is that with increasing distance from the site, there's also a diminished concentration of arsenic in these biological materials that have been analyzed, the toenails and the urine. And so there is this obvious proximity effect on exposures. Another faculty member in the department by the name of Monica Ramirez Andriotto, who I think is giving a talk right around now in a different session here, is an expert in citizen science and environmental literacy and sort of developing relationships with communities to come up with questions, research questions, collaboratively that the community wants to address through collaborations with the university. So some of the key questions that were derived from her community research were questions to whether their soils are safe in this proximity to the Superfund site. When you wake up and find out you're next to a Superfund site, you start to ask these questions. Is it safe for me to consume the vegetables that I have in my garden? And if so, how much can I do that? So she developed a project with the community to begin to collect samples from the gardens, basically turn the community into scientists collecting their own data, collected a variety of soil samples, sent them into our laboratory for analysis. We sent the data back and helped to answer and address questions that they had. So one of the data sets she had was concentrations of edible tissue arsenic in this variety of vegetable families. These are all different plant families of distinct vegetables, so lettuce, kale, radish, etc. As a function of soil arsenic concentration, again, you know, a common x-axis variable in this presentation. But each of these, you can see that there are potentially statistically significant correlations between soil arsenic concentrations and arsenic uptake into the edible plant material that was being consumed by the community. And there was separation by plant families in terms of the amount that they bioconcentrated arsenic. And so the results of this were actually comparable to some results that had been published elsewhere that showed, for example, that lettuce is a significant bioconcentrator of arsenic, followed by radish and broccoli, and the lowest of the ones measured was the common bean. All of these correlations shown on the previous slide were statistically significant except for Solanaceae and cucurbitaceae And so this kind of information can be provided to the community, and they can make assessments based on the arsenic concentrations expected in their vegetables and compare them to known concentrations for those measurements that have been made, which are not that many for market-produced vegetables. And for the most part, these are quite a bit higher. And so presumably a lot of the habits of some of these community folks have changed in respect to community gardening. So in that respect, it's worth considering then what's the nature of the source of this arsenic, where does it come from, and what's its form. And this is the tailings pile in the Iron King site. That's been left undisturbed for 50 years. It's completely devoid. There's no vegetation. There are, of course, microbes living in this tailings material, these primarily chemolithoautotrophic microbes that make a living from oxidizing iron and sulfur, but not a lot of neutrophilic heterotrophs. And there is a very high concentration of arsenic and lead in the thousands of parts per million, and not a very large dramatic change in concentration with depth through the profile. However, there is a very sharp reaction front that you can see when you look at that profile and you dig a pit in the field and go down to a couple of meters in depth. There's a redox transition zone where you can clearly see this transition from a highly oxidized material into a reduced material. And essentially what this is, it's a pedogenic process with an anthropogenically sourced mine material or mine waste. And what this sharp redox transition is, a transition from pyritic material that's reflected in both sulfur and iron X-ray absorption spectra shown here. We're going from a pyritic dominated material in both data sets to a sulfate and an iron 3 dominated material. So going from iron 2 to iron 3 in these iron zanes, and from sulfide sulfur to sulfate sulfur. And there's no transition. It's a very sharp transition in the near surface. And the dominant mineralogy is going from pyritic iron to jarosite type iron phases and ferrihydrite in the near surface as well. The arsenic then follows suit. I mean, the arsenic, these are the major elements in this soil material that's controlling the geochemistry of arsenic. Iron and sulfur undergoing a very sharp transition in the near surface. The same is true for arsenic, and you can see it both in the Zanes data and in the XFs data, even if you're not familiar with these, just looking at these as fingerprints of species in the deep subsurface. There's an arsenopyrite, so this is a sulfide-bound arsenic, and then there's a sharp transition to arsenic 5 or arsenate, and there's no evidence of any accumulation of metastable arsenic 3 or arsenite. It's just a transition from sulfide bound arsenic to sulfate or iron 3 surface bound arsenic, as indicated by the XFs data. What the data are most consistent with is a model of arsenic and bidentate binuclear coordination to iron as occurs on the surface of ferrihydrite. However, it also is the case that this type of a binding environment is quite similar in jarosite, so there's a somewhat similar jarosite coordination. So we can think of this column of soil as sort of a PM10 producing factory, or a particulate matter producing factory that's then being transported into the community nearby. So there's a sulfidic material at depth undergoing oxidation and producing fine particles of oxidized species of arsenic, iron, and sulfur in the near surface, including efflorescent salts that are readily transported by wind. And so one of the questions that we asked was, if we look at this sort of speciation trend, or the one on the previous slide, how does that translate into the bioavailability of that PM10 to the community that's living nearby? So this is PM10 particulate matter that's regulated by the EPA of a particle size less than 10 micrometers. And so we've conducted some in vitro bioaccessibility studies, which are essentially aqueous dissolution kinetics experiments. And we've used both an inhalation IVBA using a simulated lung fluid or a synthetic lung fluid, which is done under oxic conditions, and it's circumneutral in pH. And we've also used a synthetic gastric fluid, which is a higher glycine concentration, and it's done at much lower pH and under anoxic conditions. So the geochemistry of the waters that these particles come in contact with are different, but these are simulants of biological fluids in the lungs and the gastrointestinal tract. And one of the things that we observed, and this was counterintuitive to us, is that there was a significant increase in the bioaccessibility, particularly in this case for lead is shown in blue. There was an increase in bioaccessibility for lead as you increase the depth into the soil profile. The case for zinc was sort of the inverse. There was more bioaccessibility of zinc in the near surface than at depth for both lung and gastric. And in the case of the arsenic, which is our focus here, the arsenic bioaccessibility was minimum in the intermediate zone, this zone of metastable minerals, where there's a heavily high prevalence of schwertmannite and ferrihydrite. And not to get too bogged down in the details, but one of the things that we learned in this process was that the bioaccessibility assay is in itself a very interesting and complicated geochemical reaction in the biofluid, where there's a transformation of minerals. In this case, we're seeing a decrease in ferrihydrite during both synthetic gastric and synthetic lung fluid bioassays, and the production of more of this thermodynamically stable jarosite. You can see here we're going basically from the top of the soil profile down to about 2 meters in depth, and so the colors represent the prevalence of these secondary iron phases. So these are the ferric, rust-colored sort of ferric phases, ferrihydrite and jarosite, and the gray are the parent primary minerals, pyrite, and dominantly pyrite and anchorite to a smaller extent. And so you can see this weathering sequence, obviously, with depth, but also what you can see is the influence of these different reactions on the transformation. And what this amounted to was that there's a transformation of ferrihydrite-like coordination in our system to a jarosite-like coordination that makes this arsenic less bioavailable. And so a smaller amount of the arsenic is actually released into both lung fluid and gastrointestinal fluid then might be predicted on the basis of the initial material, a relatively small fraction. So the bioaccessible fraction is down in this, you know, the 2 to 10% range of the material that's ingested or inhaled, and there is a decrease in that bioaccessible fraction of arsenic with increasing short-range ordered iron concentration in the sample. So that was one of the observations we made. And I just wanted to use that sort of as an example to close and in conclusion to emphasize, and I hope I did that without bogging you down too much in some of the details of the geochemistry, that concepts and approaches in soil chemistry have direct applicability to this sort of continuum of environmental health risk assessment. And so really, soil chemistry is needed, particularly when we're dealing with geogenic sources or anthropogenic sources of material that interact with soils and are sort of forced upon by the environment and changed over time. That source undergoes weathering as a function of time and environment, changes the nature of the exposure, and therefore affects the dose that's received by individuals that are in contact with that material. Climate-driven pedogenesis alters the form and mobility of the source term. In this case, we saw that major element geochemistry changes were very important to controlling arsenic speciation and bioavailability, and therefore risk to the community. And that molecular speciation, I just said this, controls the bioaccessibility of that material. So I just wanted to acknowledge the funding from the Superfund Research Program, the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences, and the contributions of a lot of people to data that I eventually sort of plucked out of papers and put into this talk. So I'll take questions if there's time. Thanks. I've been indirectly involved. No, I have. I mean, I have not been directly involved. I've sort of been the. I've been to a couple of community events where there's been Q&A types of sessions in the open, and I've worked at a table that was for our Superfund research program. But I've been much less involved than several others in the center grant. We actually have a core facility that's called the Community Engagement Core Facility. So there are individuals whose primary occupation in the context of the grant is to reach out and interact with community individuals. And so we have had a lot of community engagement in the project. I, as a soil chemist, have not had nearly as much as I could have probably had in this project. It's a good question. Yes.
I'll start, thank you. I was wondering if you have any measurement of carbon in those layers that are down.
Yes.
Because it seems to me that you do not have enough carbon in order to have a reduction. The energy for the reduction is there.
Oh, you mean, so, yes, you're right.
The amount of energy that you have for reduction, especially in this kind of environment.
Yes. No, you're correct. We don't. And so, we don't have reduction of the arsenic. The carbon concentrations in the tailings are on the order of 0.2 to 0.7% by mass, so very low, relatively low. And we don't have arsenic reduction occurring. What we have is we have a parent material that has reduced arsenic in it that is deposited on the land surface that's now in contact with oxygen in the atmosphere, and it undergoes oxidation. And so we have an oxidation reaction front that's forming. One of the things I didn't talk about in this is that we've conducted a lot of research on phytostabilization of these mine tailings, and that involves the infusion of a large amount of reduced carbon into the mine tailings, on the order of 20% by mass in the top 20 to 30 centimeters of the tailings. And so one of our concerns was we would be reducing arsenic by introducing all of that carbon through microbial activity we may mobilize arsenic through iron reduction, we may actually reduce arsenic through arsenic reduction, but we didn't observe any significant mobilization, and we actually studied this pretty intensively, and I think that's a result of the sort of lack of structure formation so far in the soils and the fact that we've maintained oxic conditions even through irrigation for the most part.
What's really neat about this site is the tailings I was working with up to about 15, 20 years ago was actually sold as a fertilizer because it was enriched in iron. And you've probably seen it as it's called ironite. It was very commonly sold. And so people were spread this material with 6,000 ppm arsenic on their front yards just to green up their grass.
And another curiosity, is that 500 ppm for arsenic in the soil is close?
Yeah.
This was
not native concentrations. Native concentrations were more down around one or two parts per million, but this was due to the fact that there had been transport off-site of the arsenic from the tailings into this community, and it tended to decrease with distance from the site, although it wasn't a perfect linear relationship.
A little bit of rain would turn the mountain bright orange, and then wind would just distribute that flow.
Yeah.